Thank you, Mark, for inviting me, and also thank the sponsors for the invitation. I have to apologize here for the conversion of the font here. That's actually Burmese font on a decent, laptop that has Burmese fonts in it, but it translated to something else here. This is so you can pronounce my name. I do have to mention the work here is from many people, including the UC Davis biomicrometeorology team that has a lot of grad students and stuff. Okay, so the question I had here is, does the eddy covariance-based imbalance ever go away when you're taking work? And, well, maybe it can eventually. If we improve the instrumentation methods, and they have to be improved such that they're practically, economically okay to employ these methods. But right now, I think it's going to persist for a while, this imbalance for many cases, not all sites, but for many cases. Who cares? I think many of you in the audience probably care because you're interested in ET, as the previous speaker was talking about, vapor transpiration. There's also carbon balance issues, trace gas exchange, and other biometeorological type of issues that are related to using eddy covariance and the energy balance. So I just want to review this really simple stuff. I know you might be reeling from Dr. Orr's previous stuff, so I'll show you something I think that everyone can understand from about a 7th grade or 8th grade level, or maybe before that, some real basic algebra, with the concepts that the net radiation equals the sensible heat plus the latent energy plus the storage or ground conduction term. And you can rearrange this. Theoretically, this equation should be exactly balanced by the conservation of energy. So I'm not talking about relativistic stuff. I'm talking about stuff that's very much in Newtonian mechanics, where mass isn't being converted into energy and vice versa. Okay, so the general concept here is pretty simple, that the available energy, that's Rn minus G, equals essentially the heating of the air and the energy used in evaporation. You also can do the opposite sign, cooling of the air and condensation issues too. Of course, those can occur. So just to remind you that an ecosystem in the energy budget is generally abstracted as a flat surface. So we squish tall canopies, sometimes as tall as 70 meters, into something that has absolutely no theoretical height at all into a surface. And then we apply this energy budget. Just to remind you the terms in detail, the net radiation term Rn is actually technically a flux density in biomicrometeorology. That means it's watts per meter squared. The sensible heat flux density, the heating or cooling of the air by the surface, is H. The evaporative or condensation system is the latent energy flux density. It's obviously a latent energy, so it's not actually experienced by the air except for the phase change that's occurring, so the humidity stores that energy in it. And then the storage and ground heat flux density occurs both in the biomass and the ground, and we just saw the previous speaker talk about the ground, but for most canopies, there's also quite a bit of biomass that could be above that could have appreciable storage occurring too. So these all should balance. Generally, though, they're not balanced when you take measurements. So theoretically, everything works well. Or you can use something like measurements like the Bowen ratio energy budget system. That assumes energy budget closure, and then you have perfect closure by definition because of the method you're using. But when you use eddy covariance, you're measuring H and LE separately, and then you're measuring Rn minus G. And generally, you don't have the balance. Generally, Rn minus G is greater in magnitude than H plus LE. Here's an example from 10 years ago. I'm going to show you work that sometimes is quite old here because this problem has been persistent, studied for a long time, and the solutions indicate that there are no solutions, at least practically at the moment. So here's a general thing from Turnipseed back in 2002 showing that over here in the daytime, the slope is someplace around 0.85 between H plus LE versus Rn minus G, including storage here. So this indicates that the eddy covariance measures of H and LE are not matching Rn minus G. They're not balancing here in the daytime. And in the nighttime, it's even worse. You can see here in the nighttime, it's probably close to about 0.25 to 0.3 for the nighttime slope. So there's already a hint here of some of the problems that exist with eddy covariance in measuring things. Nighttime, not very good at all. Daytime, not too bad, but not perfect. So here's an example of some of Kel Wilson's pioneering work in 2002, where he compared a whole bunch of FluxNet sites and took a look at the energy balance closure, plotted it versus a turbulence measure. I prefer to use sigma W, or the vertical variance of, sorry, the standard deviation, the square root of the vertical variance of the vertical velocity, which is the real turbulent transport mechanism. But many people use the friction velocities, and this, at the time that Kel did his work, he was using friction velocity. It maps approximately, but not nowhere near exactly, between the two. So the friction velocity is a measure of turbulence. High values are very turbulent. Low values are not so turbulent. Energy balance ratio, one would be H plus LE equals RN minus G. And you can see that the energy is not balanced by H plus LE, especially at low friction velocities, but at higher friction velocities, higher turbulence levels, you do approach one, although if you looked at the average here, it's not at one. It's just some outliers there. Okay? And then at Walker Branch, the old Walker Branch site, at least in this case, Kel looked at also the regression slope, which again is a measure of one being the energy closure system. And once again, at low friction velocities at nighttime this time, you can see very low values of closure. And then at higher friction velocities, you approach something like 0.7 to 0.8 at night. Still fairly low values of turbulence occurring here because it's nighttime values. So this is showing that nighttime you're in big trouble when you use eddy covariance. And so we'll go over some of the reasons why in a moment. Oops. Let me go up to this one. One thing that I'll just point out here, some people used to think that it was vegetation height because of storage term. Ray, for example, Ray Looning, has mentioned that storage is a very important part of this, and it is, as we'll look at in a moment. But one could think that a lot of times vegetation height is loosely related to the amount of biomass. The very tall canopies sometimes have a lot of biomass involved in them, and therefore should have a lot of storage. But in this case, the energy budget closure doesn't show a great trend. It shows a little bit of a trend with higher biomass or higher vegetation height that we map to biomass, but actually not too much of a trend. So it may not, the types of problems we see here might not be just storage. There's probably something else going on. So what are the things going on? Well, I just want to also bring up that many of you are looking at trace gases. So here's an example of CO2 trace gas. And once again, at low turbulence levels, you underestimate what's going on. Perhaps as you reach some threshold, then you can start getting a fairly good estimate of respiration, maybe. So, let me just remind you the types of instruments used. I'm not trying to, although I don't work for the federal government, I do work for a state agency in a way, the University of California. So, I'm not trying to further the manufacturer, unnamed manufacturer of these devices here. But this is a sonic anemometer here that also can be used as a sonic thermometer, although Stickler for this type of stuff may use a thermocouple or a thermistor, a fine size thermistor for taking the temperature measurements. You also can use the sonic temperature that's related to the virtual temperature pretty closely. I have a paper in 2000, though, that says you actually probably should use the virtual temperature rather than using actual fine wire thermocouple or platinum resistance thermometer or something. Anyway, so that can measure both temperature and vertical wind speed. And then you also have a Erger here that can measure latent energy, CO2 flux, and the other Ergers or other devices that can measure methane and other things, isotopic fluxes and stuff like that. So that's typically what's used here, the Erger for the concentrations, like water vapor, and then the vertical velocity. Notice that you should use the 3D because sometimes your device can be a little tilted, so if you used a 1D, you wouldn't be able to see the error of tilting of the device. By using a three-dimensional sonic anemometer, you can tell the tilt. Okay, so what are some of the measurement systems that are used for the other parts of the energy budget? Net radiation and ground heat flux. Well, we have net radiometers. Here's a bunch of different types. Some of you may be familiar with the dome types that birds love to destroy, and then you have a few hundred dollars of replacement cost each time that happens. Then you have things that don't have domes, like the NR light, and then all the systems that are actually four-stream systems where you can get more information about shortwave and longwave radiation coming up. I'm not going to talk about the provenance of this. I know we had a great talk about radiometry and making sure everything's calibrated. These guys are probably way down the line in terms of transfer calibrations to very, very tertiary standards in terms of what these are. And that's normally how we measure net radiation. And then soil heat flux is frequently measured by some sort of soil heat flux plates and also maybe temperature probes in the soil with guesses of the specific heat that's represented by the changes of temperature in the soil. But also you have heating of biomass that contributes to G, or some sort of storage term. So I'll discuss that right now. It's really challenging to measure this because if you have a tall canopy or even a short canopy, all the biomass is changing its temperature in addition to the air. So you have to have all these sensors at various depths inside your biomass if you're really trying to measure this. And if there's a lot of variation, the types, the species diversity that Dr. Gammon was talking about earlier, if you have a lot of diversity, then you have to sample all these different diverse types of plants with these different types of sensors at different depths to figure out what the actual heat storage is occurring. Plus, you need to know the specific heats of all these different things. So it makes it pretty complicated to measure. Ray has given has a paper and also has given some recent talks in the last few years that says storage is a big part of many of the energy budget closures that he sees. I tend to disagree that it's ubiquitous, but I do believe in some cases it's definitely part of the reason is the storage is not well estimated for the energy budget closure. The net radiometry, as we just noticed in this earlier talk, is relatively accurate, maybe 5%, 10% or something going on with these transfer standards being so far away from the actual BIPM and WMO standards, but they're not consistently one direction or another. One person may have a net radiometer that reads too high, one too low, so you wouldn't have a consistent underestimation of the energy budget as we see generally. People have also mentioned footprint issues, but footprints, again, would not really give you a consistent error. So that really doesn't make any sense. So the net radiation really, in general, probably is not a good reason for the energy budget closure lack. So let's go to the main thing that I'll stipulate is probably the main cause in many cases. It's the eddy covariance method. I live and die by eddy covariance. I've worked on it since I started doing professional work at Davis many decades ago, probably in some cases for some of the audience before you were born. So to criticize this is not taken lightly. It's our lifeblood in terms of grant money and things like that. But in reality, eddy covariance does have its problems. And one of the problems is when you use any covariance, you're ignoring a bunch of other terms. There's a mean flux that could go vertically, a mean flux that could go horizontally, and actually a turbulent flux that also could go horizontally out of a control volume I'm showing here in a tall site. This is a model left of the Wind River canopy crane in Washington State that no longer has the jib. It still has the tower, but that jib's been taken off for economic reasons recently. So when you do eddy covariance, look at fluctuations of things like water vapor and vertical wind. You take the covariance of these, not the correlation. You can take the correlation if you want, but that won't give you the flux. You have to take the covariance. So that's why we like to call it eddy covariance, not eddy correlation. It's a covariance that gives you this flux, and here you can see a pretty good covariance going on, right, by your eye. Vertical flux up, vertical flux down, humidity down. So what direction is this? Is this condensation or evapotranspiration? In this picture here. We have one of the leaders of this. Tom, what would you say? He was working on this long before I was born, just about. One of the real leaders in this concept of micrometeorology and applications to biology. Well, okay, so vertical wind going up over the canopy, from inside the canopy upward has more humidity. So it's ET. You have ET occurring here, right? Okay, so that's this general diagram here. But remember, we have all these other possible fluxes. Eddy covariance measures this, but we have all these other possible exchange processes occurring that could occur that you ignore when you do eddy covariance. And you hope in many cases it's okay. It's generally okay, but not perfect. And on the issue then for some of these importances is whether you're near the edge of a field or not. So that's the long fetch issue. And in the daytime, you don't have to worry too much because it turns out the turbulence is pretty strong, so it mixes things up. But at the nighttime, it might be more important, and I'll discuss that in a little more detail. Okay, the other limitations too. Earlier I'm talking about just theoretically with a perfect eddy covariance sensor. But unfortunately, as many of the previous talks in this session have noted, the instrumentation itself has limits. Okay, so eddy covariance has the problem, if you use sonic anemometry, that the higher frequencies are always detectable. You have a finite volume, so small sizes and higher frequencies might not be seen. For example, in Dr. Orr's study, if he was using a sonic anemometer with that wind tunnel, it'd be in bad shape because the turbulence scales of the wind tunnel he was using are much smaller than the scales being looked at here. But out in the field, this isn't too bad perhaps, but you miss some energy. Sometimes people use a frequency or spectral correction. I cringe a little because spectral correction implies you're using the spectrum. When you use a spectrum, you have to assume Fourier-Stites integration and stuff like that, which then means you have to have stationarity, and you never have stationarity almost in the real world. So you have to be careful when you actually call it spectral, but some sort of frequency attenuation can occur here. There's also array influence, that is, there's air going around the sensors themselves that create contamination of the flow. And then this has to be attached to something, a tower or something else, and that contaminates the flow also. So these are all sort of design issues that mean that the actual experimental design you use has built-in errors associated with it. Crosswind corrections, these are also important. So the general concept is you could have insufficient fetch occurring when you're near the end of the field, and then mean flux definitely dominates. So how can you figure this out? We can figure this out using a dimensionless number. This is a dimensionless number that essentially says that your distance, when you normalize it, looks as the actual distance times the turbulent coefficient divided by the mean wind speed divided by the height of the canopy squared, or the height of your measurement squared. And if you look at that normalized difference, if you look at the fraction of exchange that's turbulent, you come up with a curve that shows that it's mainly turbulent exchange at high values of this normalized distance from an edge, but it's mainly advective mean flow when you're at very short distances from the edge. And you can use this general coefficient that says approximately 80 to 90% of the exchange is turbulent when you're about the equivalent of the height of the canopy times the mean wind speed divided by your standard deviation of the vertical wind speed. Okay, so I will conclude here, so there's time for questions. When eddy covariance is used, the energy budget generally doesn't close. Frequently 10 to 35% of the energy is missing. Nocturnal, it's much worse. Daytime, it's better. Storage may be underestimated, so in some cases this is important. I did mention if you use daily averages, Ray has pointed this out, as many of us have pointed out for many years, if you use a daily average, then storage tends to average out itself. So if you still have energy budget closure issues after you do a daily average, that's a sign of some of these other things coming into play. Generally, the H and LE have different errors. Probably H is only about 5 to 15% too low. I didn't actually show you data, but I'm just going to ask you to trust me. Latent energy is probably 10 to 25% too low during daytime conditions. During nighttime conditions, carbon dioxide could be as much as 100% or more too low, because things are mainly advective where the respiration is taking place near the ground, near that little layer that Dr. Orr was talking about. There's natural errors that can happen from instrument design. So unless the instruments are completely changed, such as remote sensing of the turbulence, which is, might be possible in the future, sort of mini RASs or mini sonar-type systems might be able to be used. Maybe some sort of miniature Doppler system where you excite the gases with some sort of laser that excites the gases and look at the actual Doppler shift. You could also possibly get something remotely and not influence the flow. But otherwise, you can estimate your errors by looking at things like your relative fetch. And you can try and measure advection, by the way, but we've done that for many years. We tried to do that, and it's very difficult. There have been whole experimental programs in Europe and stuff to try and measure advection, but it's very difficult. So that's not a really good solution either. Thank you.
There's probably time for one question, so we'll take Graham and then.
Yes. Graham. Okay.
About your very first equation, the imbalance, because, let's say you've got the crop birds in the size of, let's say, 30 or 40 micromoles per square meter.
Okay.
That's 50 or 20 watts per square meter.
Now, I didn't put C4 type issues that can occur with things like maize or some other things. Photosynthesis sometimes can be a few percent also. Tilden Myers, one of my former students, has done studies of this and shown that it can be fairly large, but we're not talking about 30% of the energy budget.
I'm not saying it would explain
that. Yeah. Yeah, it's an important thing too. I sort of glossed over that, and Greg, thanks for bringing this up. Obviously, it takes a world-renowned plant physiologist to to bring this up.
Real quick, your suggestion that the errors are smaller in the day, the fluxes are so much bigger in the day that absolute errors might be equal to or even larger in the day than at night.
This is true. The absolute errors might be about the same if you look at standard errors or something like that. But relative errors, they're smaller. That's correct. That's correct. And also, just conceptually, it's different. There's more turbulence. You have a better chance with the ideal instrument of measuring and closing the energy budget in the daytime. In the nighttime, there's just not that much turbulence. So saying that's turbulent transfer is just a false conception, because a lot of time the airflow is relatively quiescent. So you don't have the turbulence then. So that means saying it's turbulent is just wrong. It's not. Thanks.